It was in an apple tree.
"He built me a swing," Susan remembered.
She sat and stared at the thing. It was quite complicated. Insofar as the thinking behind it could be inferred from the resulting construction, it had run like this. Clearly, a swing should be hung from the stoutest branch. In fact, safety being paramount, it would be better to hang it from the two stoutest branches, one to each rope. They had turned out to be on opposite sides of the tree. Never go back, that was part of the logic. Always press on, step by logical step. So he'd removed about 6 feet from the middle of the tree's trunk, thus allowing the swing to, well, swing. The tree hadn't died, it was still quite healthy. However, the lack of a major section of trunk had presented a fresh problem. This had been overcome by the addition of two large props under the branches, a little further out from the ropes of the swing, keeping the whole top of the tree at about the right height off the ground. She remembered how she'd laughed even then, and he'd stood there quite unable to see what was wrong. And then she saw it all laid out. That was how death worked. He never understood exactly what he was doing. He'd do something, and it would turn out wrong. Her mother. Suddenly he had a grown woman on his hands and didn't know what to do next. So he did something else to make it right, which made it more wrong. Her father, death's apprentice. And when that went wrong, and its potential wrongness was built right into it, he did something else to make it right. He turned over the hourglass. After that, it was all a matter of maths. And the duty.
"Hello! Hells, Glod, tell me where we are. Hello, Stolat! Yay!"
It was an even bigger audience. There'd been more time for the posters to be up, more time for the word of mouth from Ankh Morpork. And the band realized a solid core of people had followed them from Pseudopolis. In the brief break between numbers, just before the bit where people started leaping around on the furniture, Cliff leaned over to Glod.
"You see that troll in the front row?" he said. "The one Ashfelt's jumping on the fingers of?
The one that looks like a spoil heap?"
"She was in Pseudopolis," said Cliff, beaming. "She keeps looking at me."
"Go for it, lad," said Glod, emptying the spit from his horn. "In like flint, eh?"
"You think she's one of them gropies Ashfelt told us about?"
"Could be."
Other news had travelled fast, too. Dawn saw another redecorated hotel room, a royal proclamation from Queen Kay Lee that the band was to be out of the city in 1 hour on pain of pain, and one more rapid exit. Buddy lay in the cart as it bumped over the cobbles towards Quirm. She hadn't been there. He'd scanned the audience on both nights, and she hadn't been there. He'd even got up in the middle of the night and walked through the empty streets in case she was looking for him. Now he wondered if she existed. If it came to that, he was only half certain that he existed, except for the times when he was on stage. He half listened to the conversation from the others.
"Ashfelt?"
"Yes, Mr. Glod?"
"Clifford B. can't help noticing something."
"Yes, Mr. Glod?"
"You've been carrying a heavy leather bag around, Ashfelt."
"Yes, Mr. Glod."
"It was a bit heavier this morning, I think."
"Yes, Mr. Glod."
"It's got the money in it, yes?"
"Yes, Mr. Glod."
"How much?"
"Mr. Dibbler said I wasn't to worry you with money stuff," said Ashfelt.
"We don't mind," said Cliff.
"That's right," said Glod. We want to worry."
Ashfelt licked his lips. There was something deliberate in Cliff's manner.
"About $2,000, Mr. Glod."
The cart bounced on for a while. The landscape had changed a little. There were hills, and the farms were smaller.
$2,000, said Glod.
$2,000. "Why do you keep saying $2,000?
Said Cliff.
"I've never had a chance to say $2,000.
Just don't say it so loud.
$2,000!
Shh, said Ashfelt desperately, as Glod's shout echoed off the hills.
"This is bandit country."
Glod eyed the satchel.
"You're telling me," he said. "I don't mean Mr. Dibbler."
"We're on the road between Stolat and Quirm," said Glod patiently. "This isn't the Rantops Road, this is civilization. They don't rob you on the road in civilization."
He glanced darkly at the satchel again. "They wait until you've got into the cities.
That's why it's called civilization. Can you tell me the last time anyone was ever robbed on this road?
Friday, I believe, said a voice from the rocks. Oh, bugger.
The horses reared up and then galloped forward. Ashfalt's crack of the whip had been an almost instinctive reaction. They didn't slow down until they were several miles further along the road.
Just shut up about the money, all right?
Hissed Ashfalt.
I'm a professional musician, said Glod. Of course I think about the money. How far is it to Quirm?
A lot less now, said Ashfalt. A couple of miles. And after the next hill, the city lay before them, nestling in its bay. There was a cluster of people at the town's gates, which were closed. Afternoon sunlight glittered off helmets.
What you call them long sticks with axes on the end? Said Ashfalt.
Pikes, said Buddy.
There's certainly a lot of them, said Glod.
They can't be for us, can they? Said Cliff. We're only musicians.
And I can see some men in long robes and gold chains and things, said Ashfalt.
Burgers, said Glod.
You know that horseman that passed us this morning, said Ashfalt. I'm thinking that maybe news travels.
Yeah, but we didn't break up that theatre, said Cliff.
Well, you only gave them 6 encores, said Ashfalt.
We didn't do all that rioting on the streets.
I'm sure the men with the pointy blades will understand that.
Maybe they don't want their hotels redecorated. I said it was a mistake, orange curtains with yellow wallpaper.
The cart came to a halt. A rotund man with a tricorn hat and a fur-trimmed cloak scowled uncomfortably at the band.
"Are you the musicians known as the band with rocks in?" he said.
"What seems to be the problem, officer?" said Ashfalt.
"I am the mayor of Quirm. According to the laws of Quirm, music with rocks in cannot be played in the city. Look, it says so right here."
He flourished a scroll. Glod caught it.
"That ink looks wet to me," he said.
Music with rocks in represents a public nuisance, is proven to be injurious to health and morals, and to cause unnatural gyrations of the body, said the man, pulling the scroll back.
You mean we can't come into Quirm? Said Glod.
You can come in if you must, said the mayor, but you're not to play.
Buddy stood up on the cart.
But we've got to play, he said.
The guitar swung around on its strap. He gripped the neck and raised his strumming hand threateningly. Glod looked around in desperation. Cliff and Ashfalt had put their hands over their ears.
"Ah," he said, "I think what we have here is an occasion for, negotiation, yes?"
He got down from the cart.
"I expect what your worship hasn't heard of," he said, "is the music tax."
"What music tax?" said Ashfalt and the mayor together.
"Oh, it's the latest thing," said Glod. "On account of the popularity of music with rocks in, music tax, 50p a ticket. Must have amounted to, $250 in Stolat, I reckon. More than twice that in Ankh-Morpork, of course. Patrician thought it up."
"Really? Sounds like veterinary, right enough," said the mayor.
He rubbed his chin. "Did you say $250 in Stolat, really? That place is hardly any size."
A watchman with a feather in his helmet saluted nervously.
"Excuse me, your worship, but the note from Stolat did say..."
"Just a minute," said the mayor testily. "I'm thinking."
Cliff leaned down.
"This is bribery, is it?" he whispered.
"This is taxation," said Glod.
The watchman saluted again.
"But really, sir, the guards at Sto..."
"Captain," snapped the mayor, still staring thoughtfully at Glod. "This is politics. Please..."
"As well," said Cliff.
"And to show goodwill," said Glod, "it'd be a good idea if we paid the tax before the performance, don't you think?"
The mayor looked at them in astonishment, a man not certain he could get his mind around the idea of musicians with money.
"Your worship, the message said..."
$250, said Glod.
"Your worship..."
"Now, Captain," said the mayor, apparently reaching a decision, "we know that folk are a bit odd in Stolat. It's only music, after all. I said I thought it was an odd note. I can't see the harm in music. And these young men, people, are clearly very successful," he added.
This obviously carried a lot of weight with the mayor, as it does with many people. No one likes a poor thief.
"Yes," he went on, "it'd be just like the lats to try that on us. They think we're simple, just because we live out here.
Yes, but the pseudopolis...
Oh, them stuck-up bunch. Nothing wrong with a bit of music, is there? Especially, the mayor eyed Glod, when it's for the civic good. Let them in, Captain.
Susan saddled up. She knew the place. She'd even seen it once. They'd put a new fence along the road now, but it was still dangerous. She knew the time, too. Just before they called it Dead Man's Curve.
Hello, Quirm!
Buddy struck a chord. And a pose. A faint white glow, like the glitter of cheap sequins, outlined him.
Wah!
The cheering became the familiar wall of sound.
I thought we were going to get killed by people who didn't like us, Glod thought. Now I think it's possible to be killed by people who love us.
He looked around carefully. There were guards around the walls. The captain had been no fool.
I just hope Ashfelt put the horse and cart outside like I asked him.
He glanced at Buddy, sparkling in the limelight.
A couple of encores and then down the back stairs and away, Glod thought.
The big leather satchel had been chained to Cliff's leg. Anyone snatching it would find themselves towing one ton of drummer.
I don't even know what we're going to play, thought Glod. I never do, I just blow and there it is. You can't tell me that's right.
Buddy whirled his arm like a discus thrower and a chord sprang away and into the ears of the audience. Glod raised the horn to his lips. The sound that emerged was like burning black velvet in a windowless room.
I'm going to die. That's part of the music. I'm going to die really soon. I can feel it. Every day it's getting closer.
He glanced at Buddy again. The boy was scanning the audience as if he was looking for someone in the screaming throng. They played There's a Great Deal of Shaking Happening. They played Give Me That Music with Roxin. They played Pathway to Paradise. And 100 people in the audience swore to buy a guitar in the morning. They played with heart, and especially with soul. They got out after the 9th encore. The crowd was still stamping its feet for more as they climbed through the privy window and dropped into the alley. Ashfelt emptied a sack into the leather satchel.
Another $700, he said, helping them onto the cart. Right, and we get $10 each, said Glod. You tell Mr. Dibbler, said Ashfelt, as the horse's hooves clattered towards the gates. I will. It doesn't matter, said Buddy. Sometimes you do it for the money, but sometimes you do it for the show. That'll be the day.
Glod fumbled under the seat. Ashfelt had stashed 2 crates of beer there.
There's the festival tomorrow, lads, rumbled Cliff.
The gate arch passed above them. They could still hear the stamping from here.
After that we'll have a new contract, said the dwarf, with lots of zeros in it.
We got zeros now, said Cliff.
Yeah, but they ain't got many numbers in front of them, Buddy?
They looked around. Buddy was asleep, the guitar clutched to his chest.
Out like a candle, said Glod.
He turned back again. The road stretched ahead of them, pale in the starlight.
You said you just wanted to work, said Cliff. You said you didn't want to be famous. How'd you like it, having to worry about all that gold and having girls throw their chainmail at you?
Just have to put up with it. I'd like a quarry, said the troll. Yeah? Yeah. Heart-shaped.
A dark, stormy night. A coach, horses gone, plunged through the rickety, useless fence and dropped tumbling into the gorge below. It didn't even strike an outcrop of rock before it hit the dried riverbed far below and erupted into fragments. Then the oil from the coach lamps ignited, and there was a second explosion, out of which rolled, because there are certain conventions even in a tragedy, a burning wheel. What was strange to Susan was that she felt nothing. She could think sad thoughts, because in the circumstances they had to be sad. She knew who was in the coach. But it had already happened. There was nothing she could do to stop it, because if she'd stopped it, it wouldn't have happened. And she was here watching it happen. So she hadn't, so it had. She felt the logic of the situation dropping into place like a series of huge leaden slabs. Perhaps there was somewhere where it hadn't happened. Perhaps the coach had skidded the other way. Perhaps there had been a convenient rock. Perhaps it hadn't come this way at all. Perhaps the coachman had remembered about the sudden curve. But those possibilities could only exist if there was this one. This wasn't her knowledge. It flowed in from a mind far, far older. Sometimes the only thing you could do for people was to be there. She rode Binky into the shadows by the cliff road and waited.
After a minute or two there was a clattering of stones, and a horse and rider came up an almost vertical path from the riverbed. Binky's nostrils flared. Parapsychology has no word for the uneasy feeling you have when you're in the presence of yourself, although, strictly speaking, humans feel it all the time. Susan watched Death dismount and stand, looking down at the riverbed, leaning on his scythe. She thought, but he could have done something, couldn't he? The figure straightened, but did not turn round.
Yes, I could have done something.
How did you know I was here?
Death waved a hand irritably. I remember you. And now understand this. Your parents knew things must happen. Everything must happen, somewhere. Do you not think I spoke to them of this? But I cannot give life. I can only grant extension. Changelessness. Only humans can give life, and they wanted to be human, not immortal. If it helps you, they died instantly. Instantly.
I've got to ask, Susan thought. I've got to say it, or I'm not human. I could go back and save them. Only the faintest tremor suggested that the statement was a question.
Save? For what? A life that has run out? Some things end. I know this. Sometimes I have thought otherwise, but without duty, what am I? There has to be a law.
He climbed into the saddle and, still without turning to face her, spurred Binky out and over the gorge. There was a haystack behind a livery stable in Phaedra Road. It bulged for a moment and there was a muffled swearing. A fraction of a second later there was a bout of coughing and another much better swear word inside a grain silo down near the cattle market. Very shortly after that, some rotten floorboards in an old feed store in Short Street exploded upwards, followed by a swear word that bounced off a flour sack.
"Idiot rodent!"
bellowed Albert, fingering grain out of his ear.
"Squeak! I should think so! What size do you think I am?"
Albert brushed hay and flour off his coat and walked over to the window.
"Ah," he said, "let us repair to the mended drum, then."
In Albert's pocket, sand resumed its interrupted journey from future to past. Hibiscus Dunelm had decided to close up for an hour. It was a simple process. First he and his staff collected any unbroken mugs and glasses. This didn't take long. Then there was a desultory search for any weapons with a high resale value, and a quick search of any pockets whose owners were unable to object on account of being drunk, dead, or both. Then the furniture was moved aside, and everything else was swept out of the back door and into the broad, brown bosom of the River Ankh, where it piled up and by degrees sank. Finally, Hibiscus locked and bolted the big front door. It wouldn't shut. He looked down. A boot was wedged in it.
"We're shut," he said. "No, you ain't."
The door ground back and Albert was inside.
"Have you seen this person?" he demanded, thrusting a pasteboard oblong in front of Dunelm's eyes.
This was a gross breach of etiquette. Dunelm wasn't in the kind of job where you survived if you told people you'd seen people. Dunelm could serve drinks all night without seeing anyone.
"Never seen him before in my life," he said, automatically, without even looking at the card.
"You've got to help me," said Albert, "otherwise something dreadful will happen. Push off."
Albert kicked the door shut behind him.
"Just don't say I didn't warn you," he said.
On his shoulder the Death of Rats sniffed the air suspiciously. A moment later Hibiscus was having his chin pressed firmly into the boards of one of his tables.
"Now, I know he'd come in here," said Albert, who wasn't even breathing heavily, "because everyone does, sooner or later. Have another look."
"That's a Karok card," said Hibiscus indistinctly.
"That's Death." "That's right. He's the one on the white horse. You can't miss him. Only he wouldn't look like that in here, I expect."
"Let me get this straight," said the landlord, trying desperately to wriggle out of the iron grip. "You want me to tell you if I've seen someone who doesn't look like that?"
"He'd have been odd. Odder than most."
Albert thought for a moment.
"And he'd have drunk a lot, if I know him. He always does. This is Ankh Morpork, you know. Don't be cheeky or I'll get angry."
"You mean you're not angry now?"
"I'm just impatient. You can try for angry if you like. There was
Someone a few days ago. Can't remember exactly what he looked like.
Ah, oh, that'd be him.
Drank me dry, complained about the barbarian invaders game, got legless, and then...
What?
Can't recall. We just threw him out.
Out the back door?
Yes.
But that's just river out there.
Well, most people come round before the sink.
Squeak,
said the Death of Rats.
Did he say anything?
Said Albert, too busy to pay attention.
Something about remembering everything, I think. He said being drunk didn't make him forget. Kept going on about doorknobs and
hairy sunlight. Hairy sunlight?
Something like that.
And the pressure on Hibiscus's arm was suddenly released. He waited a second or two and then very cautiously turned his head. There was no one behind him. Very carefully, Hibiscus bent down to look under the tables. Albert stepped out into the dawn, and after some fumbling, produced his box. He opened it, and glanced at his lifetimer, then snapped the lid shut.
"All right,"
he said.
"What next?"
"Squeak!"
"What?"
And someone hit him across the head. It wasn't a killing stroke. Timo Laziman of the Thieves' Guild knew what happened to thieves who killed people. The Assassin's Guild came and talked briefly to them. In fact, all they said was, "Goodbye." All he'd wanted to do was knock the old man out so that he could rifle his pockets. He'd not expected the sound as the body hit the ground. It was like the tinkle of broken glass, but with unpleasant overtones that carried on echoing into Timo's ears long after they should have stopped. Something leapt from the body and whirred into his face. Two skeletal claws grabbed his ears, and a bony muzzle jerked forward and hit him hard on the forehead. He screamed and ran for it. The Death of Rats dropped to the ground again and scurried back to Albert. It patted his face, kicked him frantically a few times, and then in desperation bit him on the nose. Then it grabbed Albert's collar and tried to pull him out of the gutter, but there was a warning tinkle of glass. The eye sockets turned madly towards the drum's closed front door. Ossified whiskers bristled. A moment later, Hibiscus opened the door, if only to stop the thunderous knocking.
"I said we..."
Something shot between his legs, paused momentarily to bite him on the ankle, and scuttled towards the back door, nose pressed firmly to the floor. It was called Hyde Park, not because people could, but because a hyde was once a measure of land capable of being ploughed by one man with 3½ oxen on a wet Thursday, and the park was exactly this amount of land, and people in Ankh-Morpork stick to tradition, and often to other things as well. And it had trees and grass, and a lake with actual fish in it. And by one of those twists of civic history, it was a fairly safe place. People seldom got mugged in Hyde Park. Muggers like somewhere safe to sunbathe, just like everyone else. It was, as it were, neutral territory. And it was already filling up, even though there was nothing much to see except the workmen still hammering together a large stage by the lake. An area behind it had been walled off with strips of cheap sacking nailed to stakes. Occasionally, excited people would try to get in and would be thrown into the lake by Chrysoprase's trolls. Among the practising musicians, Crash and his group were immediately noticeable, partly because Crash had his shirt off so that Jimbo could paint iodine on the wounds.
"I thought you were joking," he growled.
I did say it was in your bedroom," said Scum.
"How am I going to play my guitar like this?" said Crash.
"You can't play your guitar anyway," said Noddy.
"I mean, look at my hand. Look at it."
They looked at his hand. Jimbo's mum had put a glove on it after treating the wounds. They hadn't been very deep, because even a stupid leopard won't hang around anyone who wants to take his trousers off.
"A glove," said Crash in a terrible voice. "Whoever heard of a serious musician with a glove? How can I ever play my guitar with a glove on?"
"How could you ever play your guitar anyway?"
"I don't know why I put up with you three," said Crash.
You're cramping my artistic development. I'm thinking of leaving and forming my own band."
"No, you won't," said Jimbo,
"because you won't find anyone even worse than us. Let's face it, we're rubbish."
He was voicing a hitherto unspoken yet shared thought. The other musicians around them were, it was true, quite bad, but that's all they were. Some of them had some minor musical talent. As for the rest, they merely couldn't play. They didn't have a drummer who missed the drums, and a bass guitarist with the same natural rhythm as a traffic accident. And they generally settled on their name. They might be unimaginative names, like A Big Troll and Some Other Trolls, or Dwarfs with Altitude, but at least they knew who they were.
"How about we're a rubbish band?"
said Noddy, sticking his hands in his pockets. "We may be rubbish," snarled Crash, "but we're music with rocks in rubbish."
"Well, well, well, and how's it all going, then?"
said Dibbler, pushing his way through the sacking.
"It won't be long now. What are you doing here?"
"We're in the programme, Mr. Dibbler," said Crash meekly.
"How can you be in the programme when I don't know what you're called?"
said Dibbler, waving a hand irritably at one of the posters. "Your name up there, is it?"
"We're probably where it says Ants Supporting Bands," said Noddy. "What happened to your hand?" said Dibbler.
"My trousers bit it," said Crash, glowering at Scum. "Honest, Mr. Dibbler, can't you give us one more chance?"
"We'll see,"
said Dibbler, and strode away. He was feeling too cheerful to argue much. The sausages in a bun were selling very fast, but they were just covering minor expenses. There were ways of making money out of music with rocks in that he'd never thought of, and C.M.O.T. Dibbler thought of money all the time. For example, there were the shirts. They were of cotton so cheap and thin that it was practically invisible in a good light and tended to dissolve in the wash. He'd sold 600 already, at $5 each. All he had to do was buy them a 10 for a dollar from Clatchy and Wholesale Trading and pay Chalky half a dollar each to print them. And Chalky, with untroll-like initiative, had even printed off his own shirts. They said,
"Chalky's 12, the Scourers, things done."
And people were buying them, paying money to advertise Chalky's workshop. Dibbler had never dreamed that the world could work like this. It was like watching sheep shear themselves. Whatever was causing this reversal of the laws of commercial practice, he wanted in big lumps. He'd already sold the idea to Plugger the Shoemaker in New Cobblers. Pluggers, they've got souls, feel the nails. And 100 shirts had just walked out of the shop, which was more than Plugger's merchandise usually did. People wanted clothes just because they had writing on. He was making money, thousands of dollars in a day, and 100 music traps were lined up in front of the stage, ready to capture Buddy's voice. If it went on at this rate, in several billion years, he'd be rich beyond his wildest dreams. Long live music with rocks in. There was only one small cloud in this silver lining. The festival was due to start at noon. Dibbler had planned to put on a lot of the small bad groups first, that is to say, all of them, and finish with the band. So there was no reason to worry if they weren't here right now. But they weren't here right now. Dibbler was worried. A tiny dark figure quartered the shores of the Ankh, moving so fast as to be a blur. It zigzagged desperately back and forth, snuffling. People didn't see it, but they saw the rats, black, brown and grey. They were leaving the godowns and wharfs by the river, running over one another's backs in a determined attempt to get as far away as possible. A haystack heaved and gave birth to a glod. He rolled out onto the ground and groaned. Fine rain was drifting over the landscape. Then he staggered upright, looked around at the rolling fields, and disappeared behind a hedge for the moment. He trotted back a few seconds later, explored the haystack for a while until he found a part that was lumpier than normal, and kicked it repeatedly with his metal-topped boot.
"Oh!
C-flat," said Glod. "Good morning, Cliff. Hello, world. I don't think I can stand life in the fast ley line, you know, the cabbages, the bad beer, all those rats pestering you all the time."
Cliff crawled out.
"I must have had some bad ammonium chloride last night," he said. "Is the top of my head still on?"
"Yes.
Pity."
They hauled Ashfelt out by his boots and brought him round by pounding him repeatedly.
"You are our road manager," said Glod. "You're supposed to see no harm comes to us." "Well, I'm doing that, ain't I?"
Ashfelt muttered. "I'm not hitting you, Mr. Glod."
"Where's Buddy?"
The three circled the haystack, prodding at bulges which turned out to be damp hay. They found him on a small rise in the ground, not very far away. A few holly bushes grew there, carved into curves by the wind. He was sitting under one, guitar on his knees, rain plastering his hair to his face. He was asleep and soaking wet. On his lap, the guitar played raindrops.
"He's weird," said Ashfelt.
"No," said Glod, "he's wound up by some strange compulsion which leads him through dark pathways."
Yeah. Weird.
The rain was slackening off. Cliff glanced at the sky. Sun's high, he said.
Oh, no, said Ashfelt. How long were you asleep?
Same as I am awake, said Cliff.
It's almost noon. Where did I leave the horses? Has anyone seen the cart? Someone wake him up.
A few minutes later, they were back on the road.
And you know what, said Cliff, we left so quick last night, I never did know if she turned up.
What was her name, said Glod.
Dunno, said the troll.
Oh, that's real love, that is, said Glod.
Ain't you got any romance in your soul, said Cliff.
Eyes crossed in a crowded room, said Glod. Nah, not really.
They were pushed aside as Buddy leaned forward.
Shut up, he said.
The voice was low, and contained no trace whatsoever of humour.
"'We were only joking,' said Glod. "'Don't!'
Ashfelt concentrated on the road, aware of the general lack of amiability.
"'I expect you're looking forward to the festival, eh?'
he said, after a while. No one replied.
"'I expect there'll be big crowds,' he said.
There was a silence except for the clatter of the hooves and the rattle of the cart. They were in the hills now, where the road wound alongside a gorge. There wasn't even a river down there, except in the wettest season. It was a gloomy area. Ashfelt felt that it was getting gloomier.
"'I expect you'll really have fun,' he said eventually. "'Ashfelt,' said Glod. "'Yes, Mr. Glod?' "'Wash the road, will you?'